Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
On the morning of September 12, 2013, a fugitive task force arrested Arthur Fryer at his apartment in Brooklyn. His DNA entered in the FBI's criminal database after a drug conviction had been matched to evidence from a rape in Pennsylvania years earlier. Over the next year, Fryer and his lawyer fought his extradition and prosecution for the rape and another like it, which occurred in 1992. The victims, one from January of that year, the other from November, were kept anonymous in the media. This is the story of Jane Doe January. Emily Winslow was a young drama student at Carnegie Mellon University's elite conservatory in Pittsburgh when a man brutally attacked and raped her in January 1992. While the police's search for her rapist proved futile, Emily reclaimed her life. Over the course of the next two decades, she fell in love, married, had two children, and began writing mystery novels set in her new hometown of Cambridge, England. Then in fall 2013, she received shocking news. The police had found her rapist. This is her intimate memoir, the story of a woman's traumatic past catching up with her in a country far from home, surrounded by people who have no idea what she's endured. Caught between past and present and between two very different cultures, the inquisitive and restless crime novelist searches for clarity. Beginning her own investigation, she delves into Fryer's family and past, reconnects with the detectives of her case, and works with prosecutors in the months leading to trial. As she recounts her long-term quest for closure, Winslow offers a heartbreakingly honest look at a vicious crime and offers invaluable insights into the mind and heart of a victim. The book that we're featuring today is Jane Doe January, My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice, with my special guest, author Emily Winslow. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Emily Winslow.
Thanks very much, Dan. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you very much, Emily. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, in 1992, you were a 22-year-old drama student in your third year at Carnegie Mellon University, and you said at an elite conservatory in Pittsburgh. Who were you at that time? Where did you grow up? Were you a religious person, a cautious person? What was your life like before this rape in 1992?
I had grown up in New Jersey, the youngest of four kids, a teenager of the 80s, Generation X all the way. My older sister was, at the time that I was in college, a professional actress, and she had been in the program before me. So it seemed very natural to follow in her footsteps. And I felt very lucky to get in and to be there and to be part of that very small group of people. And that became key. The class at CMU of actors was so small. There were just 16 of us. And we were together, you know, from 9 in the morning till 11 at night most days. It was an exhausting program. It was really difficult sometimes, but we had each other. And having that coherent group turned out to be exactly what I needed when I had to cope with what suddenly happened in the winter of 1992. And to further answer your questions, yes, I was a devout Christian. I still am a practicing Christian. And at the time, the way that that played out is that, and I think this is what you were indicating, is that I was waiting for marriage before being physically intimate with a boyfriend. So I was rather innocent, which was something that my acting teachers sometimes struggled with. And I was very idealistic, and I think I was a little bit adventurous. I had spent the previous summer in the Middle East by myself because I wanted to see the pyramids. So that's who I was at 22 at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Now, you were at this elite conservatory, so again, you said you felt a little bit more confident because you had traveled. So, but how cautious were you? And also, tell us about this. Is it Shadyside? Tell us about this little community and how comfortable and safe did you feel before we talk about the event itself, the rape itself, the day in question. Tell us about how comfortable you felt. How naive were you? How cautious were you? And how safe did you feel in this little community?
Carnegie Mellon University is in the city of Pittsburgh, but it's not near downtown at all. It's nowhere near the skyscrapers of the city of Pittsburgh. It's in a three-neighborhood area, pretty much, Oakland, Squirrel Hill, and Shadyside. Shadyside is where I lived. It was and still is a beautiful little area based around this little street called Walnut Street, where they had a lot of fun shops and restaurants. And because I was an introvert, I had a studio apartment and lived alone. We were with each other. We were with other people all day long, constantly working with other people. And living alone was my retreat. It was I could go home and deep breaths and sort of center myself again. Shadyside was a place that seemed very safe, because it was busy. And it just seemed like a typical nice neighborhood. It was well lit. It was charming. And yes, I felt very safe there.
Now, let's get to the event itself and the circumstances in which you found yourself. As you describe in the book, you take us right through that experience itself. You are going to do laundry that night, so take it from there why you leave the building and what you notice right away and your response during all of this event leading up to the rape.
It was Christmas break. It was a Sunday, late afternoon. Classes were starting up again on Tuesday, so it was time to get to work on those monologues that I had not looked at all, that I needed to have memorized by Tuesday, and I needed to wash my clothes, and it was a coin-operated washer in the building, so I needed to get change of a dollar, and so that's why I left my apartment that evening. And as I walked out, I noticed somebody hanging around my building who I had never seen before. Like I said, it's not that odd. We were, you know, I was just a block from Walnut Street, where there are lots of people from all over in Pittsburgh. So it wasn't that strange, but it was a little strange to see somebody right next to my building. But I thought, well, it's a public street. He has a right to be there. And just went on my way. What made me remember him, because obviously that wouldn't have stuck in my mind, was that when I got my change and ran my errands and came back, is I saw him again, except he wasn't near my building. He was walking towards my building. And I'm not sure if he deliberately, cleverly planned it the way it happened, in which case, gosh, that was clever, or if it just happened to be this way timing-wise. But if he had been behind me, if he had been following me, I would have been suspicious immediately. That's creepy, being followed. And I would have had a lot of alternatives, a lot of stores I could have gone into, a lot of restaurants, a lot of people I could have turned to. But instead, what was happening was he also happened to be walking toward the same door I was, but from a completely different direction. And so that was enough for me to think, oh, he doesn't mean me. He just happens to be. He must have been waiting for a friend in front of our building. And now he's going to go ring the doorbell and see if his friend is in. So I just kept walking towards the door. But I did think to myself, you know what? I am not going to hold the door for him, you know, as you would for a neighbor. It's always a kindness to, you know, hold the door so that they don't have to get out their keys. But I thought, you know what? I don't know him. I'm just going to let the door close behind me. And I was close enough to the building, and he was far enough away from the building that actually that would have worked, except he started jogging to catch up with me and catch the door, which is exactly what happened. He caught the door, and I remember his hand catching the door right at the level of my ear. And I wished he hadn't caught the door, but I thought to myself, well, there are plenty of times I didn't want to bother, you know, digging my keys out and stuff, and so I might have jogged to catch the door behind a neighbor. So I just kind of talked myself out of it. I wasn't anxious enough to turn around and leave the building, which I could have done, but I was a little bit suspicious enough that instead of going up the stairs, and he would have had to follow me and gone right to my apartment, I decided to delay, and I fiddled with my mailbox a bit just to you know, to kill time. And he walked up the stairs, and I remember feeling relief. I felt so relieved. I thought, oh, see, what were you worried about? He's going to go upstairs and see his friend, or maybe he lives in one of the apartments upstairs, and I've never seen him before. But what I didn't realize at the time, and in fact, I didn't realize it until over 20 years later when I was looking at the notes that the police had made of how I described that night to them, is that by fiddling with my mailbox, I showed him my apartment number. And so what he was able to do was he just went upstairs, and my apartment door happened to be next to the stairwell going up to the third floor, and it's a closed stairwell without a door, and he hid in that stairwell. And when I unlocked my door, he jumped and pushed me inside the apartment, shut the door, put his hand over my mouth, pressed me against the wall, and said, "Do you want to die?"
He had spoken to you just previous to that in the apartment, and you include that in your book. It's a very interesting.
A little bit of banter
downstairs,
where he'd asked me if I was married, and you know, I said, oh, "What did I say? I think I said that's private," because I wasn't. I wasn't quick enough to lie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, once he's in your house and he says, "Do you want to die?" Of course, he has his hand over your mouth. What does he do? What is his next step? And how? What's your decision to comply, resist?
Oh,
what is your initial?
Absolutely. My top priority was not to die, and the way to do that was to cooperate. I tried to cooperate. I tried to reason with him. I asked, you know, can we do this, not that, that sort of thing. The detectives used the phrase gentleman rapist, which is a horrible, horrible phrase, but you can Google it. It is a thing. It basically describes a rapist who is not sadistic. They don't want to hurt their victim, but they are willing to hurt their victim as much as is required to get them to comply with exactly what they want. And that does describe him very well. And I did try to comply to the best of my ability. I wasn't always able to, and then he had to use some more force. He had to smother me twice. Because I was screaming. And I don't actually know if this is true, but I heard in the gossip that the upstairs neighbor had heard me screaming. But because I had stopped, they didn't do anything. And I don't hold that against him at all. I mean, we've all heard something that sounds distressing for a moment, and then it stops. Well, it stopped.
Right. And how he stopped you from screaming was to smother you and
that was the smother.
Try to stifle your breath, right?
Right.
Now, you describe in the book that it seems like this excruciatingly long period of time that he abuses you. Is there any more threats, and what, if anything else, does he say to you, and what is his behavior during this entire ordeal?
You know, it's when I was describing it to the police, I kept saying how big he was. And when I was describing it to my friends, I kept saying how long it was. You know, once I got much more distant from it, it was no more than half an hour, I don't think. And seeing him in court, you know, 20-some-odd years later, he's big, he's man-sized, but he's not as big. I think it all felt bigger and a longer amount of time than it actually was, just because it was so awful. I must say, actually, he was fairly efficient about it. He knew exactly what he wanted, and he went about getting it. And then, amazingly, wonderfully, he just left. And that was an incredible moment, because I thought for sure I was going to die. And when it seemed like he wasn't going to kill me, I thought for sure he was going to try to, you know, make it so that I could not call the police, make it so that I could not easily, you know, get out of the apartment in some way. But instead, he just, once he was done, he told me to rest, vaguely gestured to my futon, and then left and closed the door behind him. And I was able to just leap up, lock the door. That was the most important thing. And then call 911.
Now, you describe this ordeal. Again, it's an ongoing ordeal because now you've been raped, but there is a sense of relief. You do lock. You're able to lock this door, your door, and so then
yep.
call the authorities. And now is the, again, ordeal, but at least, and again, you are feeling relief as soon as you're able to reach people, because there are people that are empathetic and compassionate as soon as you approach them and they come into their, you come into their care. So tell us about the, again, the ordeal of the DNA, the rape kit itself, pardon me.
Right. Well, the police came to the apartment, several of them. I think it was, you know, two or three men and one woman. That's vaguely how I remember it, in my tiny little studio apartment. And I had been so careful to not change my clothes, not wash, not affect anything that could be evidence, because that was written about in women's magazines. I'd been reading that for years in, you know, all the women's magazines that teenagers read. So I answered the door kind of, you know, still holding my dress together. And, of course, they needed my clothes for evidence. Once I changed, they took me to the hospital, and the hospital staff were absolutely wonderful. It was McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh, probably the emergency room, I would imagine, although I'm not absolutely certain. And I remember there were lots and lots of nurses, and my doctor was a woman. And the nurses were all so, they were just very deeply concerned about what had happened to me and deeply emotional about it, even as they went about their very practical business trying to help me. And the doctor was just wonderful. While she was examining me and, you know, asking me to tell her, you know, what had happened, she kept reassuring me that I had done the right thing. And I think what she was meaning to communicate was that there was nothing in my compliance that made this not a rape. There was nothing in my compliance that made me complicit in this experience. And I really appreciated that.
Now, as well, you say that the detectives that are assigned to this case, and you also, we didn't talk about how good a look you got at this person the several times of this encounter itself, but how worthwhile was the ID that you gave to the police?
You know, I was able to bribe him generally. I mean, Dan, you know, I'm a writer. Before I wrote this memoir, I've written three crime novels. And if you read my novels, I very rarely describe characters physically, not unless there's something about their physical description that impacts another character or impacts a decision they make or something. But I very rarely just apropos of nothing, describe the way somebody looks. That's not generally what my mind keys on. So I was able to describe him as best I could, but, you know, you hear terrible stories about women who have been through a terrible experience, been through a stranger rape, identify their attacker as an eyewitness in court, swear that it's true, and they mean it, and then it turns out years later, DNA shows that it was somebody else. I would never, ever, ever want, you know, my eyewitness testimony of somebody I don't actually know to be what puts somebody away. So that's one of the wonderful blessings of DNA evidence, is that now I really truly know. Yes, I did. Once they caught him and I looked at photos of him, I absolutely recognized him. But I would never want that recognition to be the sole evidence.
Now you talked about
the police.
Go ahead.
What the detectives were mostly interested in, I should clarify, there were police that came to my apartment, right? Those were uniform police. And then there were the medical staff at the hospital. And then it's at the hospital that the detectives came. And what they were mostly interested in wasn't so much the physical description of the man. What they were interested in was my list of exactly what he did. And I'll never forget this. Detective Valenta, who I ended up reconnecting with decades later after he was arrested, after the man was arrested, not Detective Valenta, he sat down with me and he apologized for having to ask me these questions. But he said that he needed to know everything that happened because every different kind of touch would become a different charge when they caught him.
Right.
And that was just the right thing to say to me. It was just the right mix of, you know, we can do something about this, and every bit of this matters. That was just very reassuring. And rather than making me tell it again myself, he just listed different things and had me say yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And just made a little record of all the different acts that would be held against him when he was finally caught. And that was very well handled, at least for me in particular. That was very well handled.
You write in the book of the state of DNA analysis and technology at that time. As a result of this rape kit, you describe or you talk about CODIS at that time and its state of having DNA included. Tell us what you have written in the book about DNA at that time in 1992.
So in 1992, DNA analysis technology existed. It was known, it was used in court. But then, as now, DNA analysis is only useful if you are comparing two things. So if you have a suspect, you can use it. If you don't, well, you just have an analysis. You just have, I mean, I've looked at the analysis of my evidence. It's gobbledygook, if, you know, unless you're comparing it to another analysis and saying, yes, there's a match. So at that time, there were unfortunately no databases yet. That wasn't until the late 90s that states started keeping records of criminal DNA that were records of DNA analysis of people who had been convicted for various crimes. And then the FBI, their database called CODIS, came about in the late 90s that started incorporating all the states' records one by one. And that's when you could start to use the evidence from stranger rapes. That's when you could start to do something with the evidence from rapes in which there was no suspect. But until then, these evidence kits, these rape kits, just got stored. It's not because the police didn't care. It's not because the forensic lab didn't think my case was worthy, not at all. It's because there was no one to compare it to. And by the time Pennsylvania got a database, by the time the CODIS database came into its own, my case was old news. And again, it's not because they didn't care. It's because they were just trying to keep up with the current caseload. And the detective in Pittsburgh who, in 2013, when this case came to court, who was in fact working on cold cases and did so out of great care for those old victims waiting for their turn, she did that on top of her normal workload in the Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit. And even she, with all her determination and skill, could only manage to fit in an average of 2 cold cases a year out of, you know, the hundreds. So, you know, the detectives I dealt with really cared, and the medical personnel I dealt with really cared. It was just a matter of bad timing, technology-wise, and then, you know, being on the back burner.
Now, how important was, you talked about how important acting was for you and the small class and this community and the friendships and the instructors. So tell us how important it was to have these people after the rape.
I was so grateful to be surrounded by actors, not just people who happened to be actors, but, you know, actors that I was working with. On a day-to-day basis, it was very normal for us to deal with very strong emotions. We were very articulate about big emotions and dramatic situations, and we were very physically affectionate with one another, just in a friendly way. And all of that was just hugely, hugely instrumental in helping me cope, and also just having a system to put myself back into. You know, I took 3 weeks off of school, and I stayed at a friend's house. I moved in with friends immediately from the hospital. And then it was really important to have school to go back to have this structure to just slip into, and to have all these little milestones already decided and set before me, and to know that everybody around me knew what had happened, and we could talk about it, and that the boys in my class, that we would touch each other in class, you know, or just as part of a scene or something. And I knew it was a way to sort of adjust to saying, these are good men. That was the bad man. These are different. And it was just hugely reassuring. I'll never stop being grateful for their kindness, and especially for the way that they took on what happened to me as sort of something that had happened to all of us. It was an offense against us as a group, and they were hurt by it too. And it was just wonderfully reassuring.
You write that the anger that you didn't have initially, because you were still, I guess, in shock, is that some of that anger you didn't have to really express, because these people expressed that dutiful outrage and anger for you.
Yes. I mean, I did feel angry sometimes, absolutely, because I felt everything sometimes. But what was a wonderful gift is that in my friend's outrage on my behalf, they expressed anger. They expressed understanding that this was wrong, that this should be fixed, that this is horrible, that that man did a terrible thing. And all of them expressing that meant that I didn't need to prove that to anybody. I didn't need to act out for anybody to prove, hey, this is important, hey, I'm really hurt, hey, you know, he was wrong, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't have to push any of that because they acknowledged that so clearly. And that was great. I feel like that freed me to, yes, I could also be angry if that's what I felt, but I didn't have to be angry to prove anything. It was great. It was very, very, it was loving and important, and they did it very, very well.
As you say in the book, you gave yourself a year to not really get over it, but to cope with it, and you gave yourself that year that you said, okay, I'm going to be able to screw up in this year, but after that, I'm going to buckle down. You do graduate from acting classes, from school. And what, tell us now this transition. You've always written, but how does it become you become a crime novelist? And tell us how you do begin to, other than supportive people, how do you go about rebuilding your life? And is this crime, this writing, any part of that? Is there any influence whatsoever at all, as other people asked you in your book, you read about it. So tell us about this transition, and how is it that you become from acting to writing, and how do you rebuild your life in actuality?
Well, about that year that I gave myself, it's a bit like when I'm working on a new book and I give myself these little mini deadlines along the way. I almost never, never make my little self-imposed deadlines. But they're hopeful. They're something to aim for. And, you know, it's not like a year went by and then I just decided, okay, well, that's over now. But
sure.
I was aiming for that. I was trying. And it wasn't just about how, okay, in a year I'm not going to let myself be a mess anymore. It was more like, right now, until we hit that year, no guilt. Be as much of a mess as you need to be. It was giving me that freedom. It's like, look, it's kind of like when you wake up in the morning and you know you have to get up at 7 and you've woken up and it's not 7 yet. And it's like, okay, I don't actually have to deal with this yet. And so giving myself that year, it wasn't a pressure. It was the opposite. It was just for right now, you don't need to worry about being a mess. Being a mess is completely appropriate. And so it was 18 months to graduate. And, you know, everything was the school, the program let me have some leeway. But for the most part, I did everything same as everyone else. And I acted in all the same plays. And that was a wonderful stabilizing normalcy, having that to work on each day. I don't know if I left acting, or rather declined to pursue acting, because of the rape. A lot of people ask me that because it was such a big change to get into this program, to actually make it through this program, and then decide not to go to New York, not audition. I honestly don't know if it was because of the rape, because how do you ever know who you would have been or what you would have done anyway? You know, the early 20s is a time of such change and trying out different things. So it's hard to say. But before I had gone to this conservatory, I had been trying to choose between writing, acting, writing, acting, writing, acting. And after finishing at CMU, I must admit I found writing to be a real relief as an introvert, not just because I could do it alone, but also because it was judged from a distance. In acting school, you're given all the feedback you're given is so personal, and it's right to your face. And it's not just about being good or bad at acting, but it's about, you know, we're going to reteach you how to walk. We're going to reteach you how to sit. We're going to reteach you literally to breathe. They want to start from scratch and teach you how to breathe. And so one can just feel very fundamentally criticized over and over and over again. And, of course, as a writer, one can be fundamentally criticized. But at least it doesn't happen with people face-to-face with you in the same room. So it seemed like, oh, that's a vast improvement.
Yeah.
So that's why I decided, okay, well, let's do this. And I was doing some research for a play I wanted to write and ended up going to graduate school to complete that research. And, you know, you asked me how do you get over it? And I think it's important to say that I don't think I got over it or past it. It's I incorporated it. This thing, it happened, it was terrible, and it's part of me. I guess when people say over it, they mean how do you get over the negativity of the event controlling you, you know. And that certainly is an important thing to try to do. But I guess for me, I don't feel like I got away from it so much as I just accepted it and made something else out of it. I started writing about it very shortly after it happened. And that was how I won my first writing awards. And that was very gratifying. You know, obviously, you know, people talk about how writing about it is therapeutic. You're letting it out. And that's true, that there is a therapeutic aspect to that honesty. But beyond that for me is not just getting it out, but getting it out and then taking that raw material and using skill and using conscious decision-making, using talent, using my mind to create something that stands alone, that stands apart from me as a work of art, as something I can be proud of. That's what was truly therapeutic to me, was taking it and turning it into something useful, turning it into something beautiful, turning it into something good.
Now, while you have a burgeoning career as a crime novelist, also you build in the most important way, and that is a very loving relationship, and to meet your husband, future husband, Gavin. And then you wind up in Cambridge, England. So this completely different life from New Jersey to Pittsburgh to Cambridge, England. So tell us a little bit about, and you don't go too much into it, and you do talk about your children a little bit, but obviously your husband is an extraordinary person. And you're going through this. Before we talk about what happens in 2013, just tell us a little bit about part of this rebuilding process, where you meet the love of your life and rebuild and have a family.
It was actually the semester that the rape happened that my best friend, who was at college in Ohio, had a semester abroad in Cambridge, England, and met the man who eventually became my husband. I still have a letter she wrote me at that time saying that she'd met him and had a crush on him. And they became good friends and kept in touch for years after she came back to America. And after she came back to America was when she decided that actually I would be a better match with him than her. And she spent 5 years trying to set us up, which was really hard because we lived in different countries. She finally managed it 5 years later. And after we'd heard about each other from her for those 5 years, and when we finally met, we got married 8 months later, which was just lovely. And we lived in Silicon Valley, California, because of his job. And we had baby number one, and then to New England, baby number two, and then back to Cambridge, England, because we thought that would be a really great place to raise the kids. It's a beautiful city. It's an inspiring city. And the university is so generous and open with all kinds of educational activities and inspiration. And for me, the surprise was when I got here, it's Cambridge, that finally was the last puzzle piece I needed to write my first novel. I had been writing for magazines. I had been a puzzle designer. I, you know, had been writing poetry and essays and plays, but I'd wanted to write a novel. And it was finally when I got here to this city that something finally clicked into place. And that's the novel that became The Whole World, which was my first crime novel, the first in the series. And I'm still writing a crime novel set in Cambridge today.
Now, meanwhile, while this is going on, you are in touch with numerous detectives. As you say, they don't stay too long in the sexual assault unit. And this is years, over the years, you keep contacting every once in a while, and you say it's very frustrating. Why is it frustrating? Tell us your experience with the police over the years contacting detectives.
First of all, it's for me, I prefer to write. Email is the greatest thing ever invented because you can organize your thoughts and present them coherently and send them off, and then somebody else can reply to them once they've organized their thoughts. Having to phone the police cold was always very stressful. I would phone them every 2 or 3 years just to check up on progress on my case and to ask them to look again at my case. And when I'd phone, you know, almost always whoever I had spoken to, you know, 2 years prior or 3 years prior wouldn't work there anymore. And so I'd be handed off to a random person who, of course, you know, those shady side rapes in 1992 were just, you know, out of many, completely forgotten. So I'd have to tell the whole story over again. And even if, you know, when this prosecution was happening and I had detectives and there were active, who were actively working on my case, even then phoning was stressful because you never knew what shifts they were working. So I'd be trying to figure out the time difference between England and Pittsburgh, and when should I call? It's not like they worked office hours, and I could say, okay, it's 10 a.m. in Pittsburgh, they should be in. What if they had worked the night before the overnight shift or something? So it was just never knowing when was the right time, never knowing who you were going to get, always having to explain, explain, explain to essentially a stranger. And one of the saddest moments I remember was when I was changing my address book, my handwritten address book, into digital. You know, I was typing everything in. And I had in the last leaf of the book the names of all the detectives that I had spoken to over years and years and years, just constantly changing, changing, changing. And I threw the address book away without copying the names out. Because I thought, what does it matter? They're gone, one after another. That detective's left, that detective's left, that detective's left. Doesn't matter. I just threw it away.
Now tell us, unlike where you were in 1992, where were you in 2013 when you got the call? And what was new in your life, or what was real prominent in your life at that time? Tell us what you were doing when you got that call and your reaction.
In 2013, our sons were around 12 and 8. And my husband had a lovely tech job, and we were living in this beautiful city, house full of musical instruments, because both our boys are musicians, and a very happy life, and working on book number 3. And when I got the call that that this man had been identified and arrested, it's, of course, a call that I had dreamed of over those years. You know, it was at that point 21 years since the rape itself. And over those 21 years, of course, I had dreamed over and over and over again that I wanted this good thing to happen. But I had always assumed that the process would be, you know, first the detectives finally agree to pull my evidence kit, which had not yet happened over those 21 years of me asking them, that they would finally agree to put it in line at the lab to be analyzed. And then, of course, that would take weeks or months, and then we might get a result, and then we might get a match, and then they might there might be an arrest. I thought, you know, this would happen, you know, this would be steps along a fairly long process. But this came out of nowhere, because they weren't arresting him for my evidence. They weren't arresting him for my case. What had happened was in 1992, in November, which was 10 months after my attack, very near me, just a couple of streets away, there had been another rape. And I remember when it was reported in the newspaper, one of my teachers told me about it because it seemed very obvious that it was likely the same man. And the police thought the same thing. So they had actually pulled the kit of this November victim and analyzed her evidence and identified the man and gone to arrest him. He was at that time living in Brooklyn. And so when I got the news, it was amazing news, but it really, really came out of nowhere. And also it came for another woman's case, not specifically mine, although they were now determined to try to link it to mine. So it was full of hopefulness that, oh my gosh, this is finally happening. My case is going to go to court. But on the other hand, all this tension of, what if my evidence still isn't viable? What if it is viable and it's not this man? What if her case goes forward and I'm just left behind? I'm so close, but will I get that last, you know, few months forward and find that this is actually happening? And I feel like those few months waiting for the lab tests of my evidence and waiting for his extradition from New York to Pennsylvania probably felt longer than the intervening 20 years.
I didn't know this, too, and that he fought the extradition from state to state, and he basically fought the extradition on what grounds?
As I understand it, the way the detectives explained it to me, they were flabbergasted, to be honest, because when you're being extradited, you can't fight extradition on the basis of, I didn't commit the crime. You fight extradition on the basis of, whoa, you've got the wrong person. So he was claiming to not be the person that they said he was. But, of course, they not only had DNA, they had fingerprints, they had photographs from a different time he'd been in the Pennsylvania legal system. So they were absolutely certain they had the right man. But as long as he claimed that they didn't, this delay just went on and on.
Now, this time is spent well by the prosecution to get more of your ducks in a row, but also, what do you do shortly after with this in terms of your own investigation into Arthur, we'll say Arthur Fryer, who you find out is the perpetrator? So what do the police do, or the prosecutor, pardon me, in this interim, and what do you soon launch yourself into?
Well, at the point of arrest, there wasn't a prosecutor yet. At that point, we're still in the first half of Law and Order program where it's all detectives. so we haven't been assigned legal representation yet. And as we're getting closer and closer to that, the rule was that as soon as he makes it to Pennsylvania, as soon as he is successfully extradited, that he has to be charged and the preliminary hearing has to happen within a very short period of time on his arrival. That's all part of having a speedy trial.
Right.
So, you know, we were just waiting and waiting. Once the extradition happened, it was all going to go very fast in terms of the first time I was going to be testifying. And what I was picturing was when we would finally get into court, I imagined that I would get to learn all these things I wanted to know. I would get to learn who he is and why he did it. Why does he rape anybody? Why did he choose me? How did he end up in Shadyside that night? Why there? Why my building? All these things I wanted to know. And yet once we got a prosecutor assigned to us, and once I went through the preliminary hearing, which is a sort of rehearsal of court, but much more casual. It's in the municipal court building instead of the proper courthouse. And it's, you know, it's just got regular chairs, you know, nothing fancy, no witness box to sit in. And the judge, I kid you not, chewed gum the entire time, which actually relaxed me and made me laugh. I thought that was quite funny. Once I went through that process and we got assigned prosecutors and we were starting to actually build the case, I realized that I was the only person who wanted all that information. The detectives and the prosecutors only needed evidence and information about our cases. They only needed to know what happened to me and the other victim. They only needed to know what happened those nights. And I realized that nobody was going to be looking for the explanations that I was craving, the explanations that to me are part and parcel of finally finding out who this guy is. So it was after the preliminary hearing in January 2014 that I came back to England, and we were preparing for what would become the proper trial, eventually scheduled for October, that I realized if I wanted to know any of this, I was going to have to figure it out myself. And so I put some bounds on myself. I absolutely never, ever want to interact with him, so that's completely off the table. I also don't want to at all interact with his family. And in my book, I'm very careful to never use the names of any family members because, you know, it's not their fault that they're related to him.
Sure.
And so I was pretty limited, but the internet is a wonderful thing and also a pretty maddening thing because just because you find a page on the internet that says something doesn't mean it's exactly right, doesn't mean it necessarily means what you think it means. A lot of times there would be a place name and it was unclear, well, is that a county or a city? A lot of times there would be an incarceration date. Is that the date he went in, the date he went out, the date he was sentenced, the date the crime happened? There was a lot of ambiguity, especially since I'm looking for the life of somebody who was born in, I think, 1952. So, of course, most of his life is pre-internet. But I was able to use not only the internet, but also the Freedom of Information Act to find out about his history in the military and calling county clerk's offices to try to trace his record of arrests and incarcerations. And I was finally able to put together a story of his life. And it's not a story that answered the why questions. And it's not a story that that gave me any kind of explanatory trauma. You know, when I found out his age, I was like, oh, he could have been in the Vietnam War. Maybe that messed him up, you know. But although he was in the armed forces during Vietnam, he never left America, you know. I kept searching for some, you know, like when you're seeing a movie and they finally give you the origin story of the bad guy and you just go, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
And I never did find that. But I found two things that I hadn't realized I was looking for, but that turned out to be really, really helpful. I mean, the first thing is that all of these little discoveries, especially, I mean, something as ridiculous as finding a picture of him on Facebook of him playing the guitar, it humanized him in a way that made me realize that, to me, he had been this powerful force, you know, this force that had appeared in my life out of nowhere and done this terrible thing and then disappeared again. And by researching and looking into his life, he just gradually became smaller and smaller until he was just a person, you know. He was just the size of me and everybody else. And that, of course, was wonderfully comforting. And the other thing is that, you know, I had always hoped that I would hear him testify. Although realistically, I mean, probably if I had thought about it really hard, I probably would have always known he would never testify. It's not really in his favor to do so with all the evidence against him. But I had always hoped to hear in his words, what was this to him? And while I'll never have that, what eventually was found, and this was, you know, when I was writing out the chapters where I'm doing the research, it genuinely happened this way. I did not manipulate the timing of this. This was the piece of information that I wanted most and had been trying from the start to get so hard, was delayed by all kinds of things outside of my control, and it arrived last. And what it was he had been convicted of rape back in the 70s and served 7 years in Sing Sing. And I'd been trying to get information about that case. You know, the mentions in the newspaper were exceedingly brief. And given my track record of the information I'd been getting about other arrests and incarceration, I wasn't expecting much. You know, by now, you know, a lot of that stuff has been, you know, shredded or mislaid, or it's just gone. And if you do get it, it tends to be a summary, not, you know, the actual file. But this, it was found for me, this county clerk's office in upstate New York sent me this envelope. It ended up being like half an inch thick of documents. I know half an inch does not sound impressive, but when everything else I'd been getting had been a single sheet of paper, or like maybe three if it's really generous, getting a half inch stack of paper in the mail was very exciting. And what I found in there, which absolutely shocked me, so I had been referring to this rape for which he was arrested in 1976, I think. I'd been calling it his first known rape, and I'd been couching it that way. Because, of course, just because this is the first one that he was arrested for doesn't mean that it was the first one that he committed. But right. Actually, once I got this packet in the mail, I believe that this was his first rape, because what he did afterward is he drove himself straight to the police station and confessed it. And there in those documents was his detailed confession of what I believe was the first time he did this terrible act. And, you know, it's not a confession of what he did to me. But it, I guess it accomplished the same thing for me seeing it in his words, not what he did to me, seeing his point of view on him doing this act, I guess it was sufficient. And I got enough information at that point that I was able to stop and say, this is enough.
Now, during this, you don't know the outcome of what's going to happen with Arthur Fryer. He may have a plea agreement. He may say he's remorseful and wants a plea deal. And you're not sure what is going on. So tell us about that sense of trepidation as well. You've gone through the preliminary. And what's very profound, too, is you include in the book that you didn't want to look at him. So you basically shuffled in there with the biggest defenders, these detectives. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's just a profound scene in your book.
Well, when I was preparing for the preliminary hearing, which, you know, on the one hand, I'd been itching to go to, you know, for months as soon as the arrest happened. We were waiting and waiting for the extradition. So it seemed like forever. But then when the extradition finally happened, boom, I had to travel almost right away because, by law, it had to happen very quickly. And I thought, as I was preparing for that, I just assumed that it was obvious that the most profound thing of that trip to Pittsburgh was going to be seeing this man again after what was, at that point, 22 years. And, and I wondered, will I be frightened? Will I be angry? Will I even recognize him? Will he recognize me? Will I see him recognizing me, and how will he react to me? Will he, will he look ashamed, or will he look angry, or will he, leer at me? I don't know. It was all this, what is it going to be like to see him again? And I assumed that was going to be the most important thing that happened. Anyway, I went to Pittsburgh, and I reconnected with the detective who had questioned me at the hospital, who had since retired from the police and was now working at University of Pittsburgh. And he was really wonderful. He had been helping me over email, helping me deal with the current detectives and get the information that I wanted about how the case was going. I got to meet the current detectives. I got to meet our prosecutor for the first time. And what ended up happening was that after testifying, when I phoned my husband to tell him what that had been like, when I emailed my friends back home to tell them what that had been like, I didn't talk about seeing Arthur Fryer. I talked about the detectives and the prosecutor and the judge who was chewing gum. The good guys seemed so much more significant. Interacting with them it was such a gift how much they cared. And getting to know them in person and seeing how they took care of me. And what you're describing in court is, so in the municipal courthouse, as I said, they don't have witness boxes. So instead of you sitting facing out to the audience is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, out to all the people in the courtroom. Instead, you just stand up and face the judge and just talk to him from a standing position. And so when it was my turn to testify, we all stood in a line, and it was me, my old detective, my new detective, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, and Arthur Fryer at the end of that line. And the two detectives and the prosecutor were all tall men. And the prosecutor specifically and deliberately, when he was asking me questions, positioned himself to block my view of Arthur Fryer. And that physical arrangement of them being so much bigger than him that I literally couldn't even see Arthur Fryer. That is a perfect metaphor for how I felt coming away from that experience, that that the good guys were so much more important in my life than that person who had done that terrible thing.
And you talk about the important people. As we talked about, you get this information from a very, very helpful person that you meet via telephone named Mary. But this is 7 weeks away from this trial or his formal plea. And another person that really helped you was this, again, you had mentioned April Campbell, the person with enough work on her to occupy her time, but still doing a couple cool cases a year, going over and beyond the call of duty. And so she becomes, along with Bill and with Don Honan and April, these are the people that help you prepare for this. Again, I can't even imagine the trepidation that you are feeling in this 7 weeks of something that you've anticipated for your entire life. So tell us, what is the process behind there, and what is the risk, and what are the things that could go wrong, and tell us what is happening just prior to this anticipated trial.
Well, you know, the obvious thing is that, of course, you want to win the case. You want to get a conviction, and you want to get a good sentence. That's the obvious goal that everybody shares. But where I differed with the prosecutors, and the prosecutors were absolutely wonderful, is it was really important to me to be able to testify. And if Arthur Fryer pled guilty, then my testimony would not be necessary, because it would not be necessary to present evidence to try to prove his guilt, because he would have already acknowledged his guilt. So it became this huge stress of, you know, the case is going so great, the case is going so well. The prosecutor was convinced that Arthur Fryer would plead, and actually, if you look at statistics, it bears that out, conviction statistics. And so he was delivering that to me as good news. Good news, he's probably going to plead. We have a perfect case. He'll probably plead. Then we don't have to worry about a jury. Because, as you know, the jury has to all agree. One person doesn't like the victim. The jury, it can go wrong. It's unpredictable, even when you have a great case. And I, on the other hand, was saying, no, I don't want that to happen, because I want to testify. And part of the reason that testifying was so important to me is that a victim actually has two opportunities to speak in a court case. The first is to testify, and that's when you describe what the person did to you. You describe their criminal actions. That's what I wanted to say. The second thing where a victim has the opportunity to speak is in the sentencing phase, and that's called a victim impact statement. And I absolutely dreaded the victim impact statement. And the reason why I didn't like that is because the victim impact statement, rather than talking about what the bad person did, you're saying how what he did affected you. And I felt like the fact that I had built a good life afterward would be taken as minimizing his crime. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that was fair, that me having made something out of this, that me having had a great support system, that made what he did less bad, less worthy of punishment. Well, I was reading, you know, newspaper stories of other rape cases in Pittsburgh, and the victim impact statements would be full of, you know, my career never recovered, my marriage fell apart, never had sex again, you know, all these, you know, attempted suicide, all these enormous things. And the feeling I got is that was how you purchased a sentence. You purchased a sentence by proving he ruined your life. And I think that is a terrible price to ask a victim to pay, to have to say, yes, he ruined my life, and that's the only way you're going to get a good, strong sentence. I don't want the court case to be about me at all. So I resented the heck out of the victim impact statement, and I felt like if he pled, that's all I would be left with. And that really weighed on me, and I honestly thought, I felt like that's the worst that could happen. And, of course, worse happened.
Now, you are prepared for this, and your husband, Gavin, is prepared for this, and your children to a certain degree, because they're young, you don't really let them in on it, but they know you're a crime novelist and you're writing about detectives, so you find a way to sort of explain this, and you're prepared to leave England and go to Pittsburgh on your own. You want to go on your own, and you need to do it on your own. What happens? You alluded to something worse that could happen. What does happen and why?
So one of the things that surprised me about the case continually as I was learning about the laws that were affecting my case, as I was trying to learn about Fryer's history in the judicial system, is that each state is very different in their laws. We're all part of the same country, but the way crimes and sentences are handled vary very much from state to state, and each state is its own little kingdom and don't necessarily communicate with each other very well. And what ended up happening in our case, literally just 3 days before I was to fly to testify in court, is that a Pennsylvania law that was the crux of our whole case, a precedent was discovered in another state that had been deemed unconstitutional. And while states have all this power over their own laws, the one thing a state cannot do is be unconstitutional. And because a similar law in another state had been deemed unconstitutional, that meant that by precedent, the law that was on which our case was based was also unconstitutional, and the case would have to be withdrawn. What this law was, it had to do with the statute of limitations. Now, this is a lot like the DNA evidence, you know. People knew about DNA evidence from the late 80s, early 90s. But statutes of limitations took much longer to catch up. Statutes of limitations were from, you know, he said, she said days when there wasn't something concrete proof like DNA evidence.
Right.
And so I remember following for years how states were trying to account for DNA evidence. And there were two ways that seemed to come up over and over again. One was no-name warrants. That's where some jurisdictions would try, instead of they didn't have the person to accuse, they didn't have the person to charge and arrest. Instead, they would say, I charge John Doe, the person with this pattern of DNA, so that they could say, yes, we did charge this crime within the statute of limitations. Maybe they'll catch him, you know, decades later. What Pennsylvania did to try to get around the statute of limitations for their old cases that had DNA evidence was they passed a law, I believe called something like a DNA exception, which is that if you have new DNA evidence that points to a previously unsuspected person, then you have a fresh year on top of that statute of limitations. And that year begins from the time that that DNA match comes to be discovered. And you have a year to charge this person and bring them to court. And that law had been used successfully several times to bring old rapists to justice in Pittsburgh. Unfortunately, in our case, because that law was passed in, I believe, 2004, when our cases were already out of statute of limitations, what the Supreme Court had decided, and as much as it breaks my heart, I understand why they felt this was right. You know, in order to break a law, it has to be a law that exists when you commit the act, right? You can't arrest somebody for a law that you make up after the fact.
Sure.
And in the same way, the Supreme Court said, unless a crime is still within their statute of limitations when the DNA exception law was passed, it cannot be applied. So our case, having already been out of statute of limitations when the DNA exception law was put onto the books, we were not eligible to benefit from it. And so the case just evaporated, just like that.
Now, despite that, you had already had plans to go to Pittsburgh and reconnect with the detectives and prepare for this trial. So you cancel the trip and stay home. What do you do?
No, it turned out to be easier to just do exactly what I had planned to do, to go to the airport, to get on the plane, to get to the hotel. And instead of spending those days in court, I spent those days with the detectives and the prosecutors. One of the prosecutors took me around the courthouse. He took me into the courtroom, and he said, "This is where you would have sat. This is where I would have sat. This is where I would have stood while you testified to make sure you looked at the jury. This is in this way. I could have made sure that they could hear you. That's where the judge would be." You know, what happened was we grieved the case together. And that was hugely important. Just like with my drama class, it was about us experiencing a loss together, not just me experiencing a loss and them, you know, looking after me. We were all grieved by what had happened, and we shared that. And, you know, it was hard. It was hard coming to grips with that this was not going to end the way that I wanted it to end, not least because, you know, if you have a conviction and you get a sentence, you can say something like, "Yes, this terrible thing that was done to me, this was worth, you know, 30 years of a man's life. That's how bad it was." You know, you can it gives it a value that's, you know, that somebody else, that a bunch of other people have agreed, yes, this crime was worth that. That's how significant it is. And, you know, all of that was lost. But what I had been pursuing for those two decades that I kept calling the Pittsburgh police was, you know, it was unfinished business. I knew there was more to be done. We had this evidence kit. It had never been tested. There was more that we could do. Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's do it. And even though we didn't get the ending we wanted, all of us had done all that we could. And that was a finish of sorts. And just as, you know, at the preliminary hearing, that the good guys became more important, were revealed to me more important and more significant in my life than the man, than the bad man. That's how I referred to him in my mind for 20 years when I didn't know his name. I still don't like to say his name. You know, in the end, the fact that we all tried, that we all gave it all that we had, you know, there's no unfinished business anymore. It didn't end the way that we wanted, but it is over. We did what we could. And, you know, when I think of the rape, you know, capital T, capital R, that event in my life. I don't just think of that half hour in my apartment. You know, I think of the nurses in the hospital who were so emotional and so kind, and the police and the detectives who were so efficient and determined and kind. And then my class, it expands even farther. Well, it's that whole, you know, year and a half that I finished university, and my friends and my teachers and my family were all so kind. And then it goes on to include this prosecution. And, you know, obviously the rape was a terrible thing, obviously, if you just look at that half hour, if you just look at what Arthur Fryer did. But if you think of it as something that started with the rape and became a much larger thing, that larger thing is full of good people and so much kindness. And so it's the rape itself is a terrible thing, but the larger thing that it set into motion is full of goodness.
A testament to you literally, again, it sounds a cliche, but you moving forward in your life is when I ask you this question, and it's in the book as well, this sentiment of just what you had just described, that you had gotten a significant cathartic effect from this entire process, regardless that you didn't get what you had initially thought would be the most important thing to get. And so what happens to Arthur Fryer? Again, a testament of you moving forward. What happens to Arthur Fryer, and what's your reaction?
You know, he was released from prison the Monday after the weekend that I got to Pittsburgh, and none of us know what he's doing. He might have gone home to be with family. He might have stayed in Pittsburgh. He might have gone back to New York. I don't check up on him anymore. I don't look online for him anymore. We had our shot in court. We didn't get it. And he's doing whatever he's doing. And I'm living my lovely life with good people over here.
And yes, and again, another great benefit of this is this wonderful book, Jane Doe January, My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice. I want to thank you very much, Emily, for coming on and talking about this. It's been an incredible interview with you. For those that might want to look at your particular work with HarperCollins, your fictional work,
yep,
and this book, do you do Facebook, and how can they maybe contact you or take a look at that other work?
My website has all of my information. That's http://www.emilywinslow.com. It's got my three novels, crime novels set in Cambridge, England, and it's got all the information about the memoir. You can follow me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, although I don't tweet very much.
Well, I want to thank you, Emily. It's been very, very good of you to come on and talk about this. Jane Doe January, thank you very much, and you have a fantastic day. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dan. Bye.
Thank you, Emily.